All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org is the website. There's also a page there where you can donate, help support the show. ScottHorton.org/donate if you're into that kind of thing. Our first guest today is Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. And in fact, I bet if I look, I'll have a whole bio written out here. The wife does such a good job preparing all this stuff for me in the morning. Doug Bandow is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. A former special assistant to President Ronald Reagan, he's the author of several books, including Foreign Follies, America's New Global Empire. Of course, he also writes regularly for Forbes.com. Welcome back to the show. Doug, how are you doing?
Doing okay.
Well, good. I'm very happy to have you here. So, I assume that you read this piece in the Washington Post. It's getting a lot of attention. It was published yesterday. It's by Greg Jaffe. U.S. Model for a Future War Fans Tensions with China and Inside the Pentagon. So now, I guess let me just say, first of all, yeah, the Pentagon has a war for, or a plan for, sorry, slip of the tongue there. The Pentagon has a plan for a war with everybody all the time, including France or whoever, right? And so what's the big deal here?
Well, I mean, to some degree, that's true. That is, if you're at the Pentagon, you're supposed to plan for worst case and, you know, assume kind of anything bad can happen. On the other hand, they're spending a fair amount of money on this. And you have to ask, you know, are they making enemies where there's no conceivable reason to have one?
And that's are the they making here. Enemies where there's no conceivable reason to have one?
Well, that's certainly what this looks like. You know, they're paying this kind of think tank several million dollars a year to do studies on how to fight China. And, of course, the question is, why would we want to fight China? That, they've come up with a whole analysis kind of predicated on a Chinese attack on the United States, and it's pretty hard to imagine why that would happen. Quite frankly, all of the scenarios that one can imagine are America attacking China, and I don't see any reason for us to want to do that.
Well, I mean, the obvious one would be they go ahead and move on Taiwan, right?
No, that's right. But the point is, none of these scenarios have anything to do with defending America. All of the scenarios have to do with defending allies or, you know, kind of asserting U.S. influence. I mean, it kind of shows where we're at in the world today, that the Defense Department no longer does defense. The Defense Department does, you know, kind of aggressive war against other countries if they do things we don't like. It's a very different thing.
Collective security.
That's right. I mean, it's the idea that we have to defend basically everybody else on the planet, and somehow that's related to defending ourselves, even when in so many cases it simply has nothing to do with it.
Well, now, as far as that goes, am I right that Taiwan might as well be Texas? There would be war if China tried to invade and conquer Taiwan. The U.S. would go to war with China over that, wouldn't they?
Well, I think so, but that could change. I mean, the critical thing is that as China gains a deterrent capability and the ability to sink American carriers, you know, that may change the calculus.
Well, they can drop a hydrogen bomb on my hometown right now.
Yeah, the thing is, China, it's a question of kind of escalation where China doesn't want to threaten nuclear war if it decides it wants to take over Taiwan. What it wants to do is be able to deter the U.S. conventionally but have nuclear forces so the U.S. can't threaten them with nuclear force.
And
I think we're moving to that time where they have submarines and missiles that could sink American carriers. That forces a U.S. president to make a very different decision. So we might be coming to a point where the U.S. simply can't assume it can defend Taiwan. And then that brings in the kind of analysis the Washington Post was talking about. You know, this air-sea-land battle and kind of all this complicated, you know, how the U.S. would strike deep into China, kind of all this craziness, which is what the Pentagon's paying a lot of money for.
Yeah, see, this is the whole Dr. Strangelove fightable war against China instead of MacArthur, you're fired because we just absolutely cannot ever have a war with China, period. You know, that was the old doctrine. Now it's, you know how we could fight and win a war with China and probably it won't come to nuclear blows? What?
Well, you know, it's also, I mean, even, I mean, the Truman folks would have gone to war with China, say, to defend Japan. But they recognized that it made no sense to have a war on the Asian mainland. Over Korea, and that they recognize far better to have a stalemate on the Korean Peninsula than have another world war. So, I mean, even a very hawkish administration in the middle of the Cold War recognized that war with China was a very bad deal. And you didn't jump into this kind of, you know, frivolously, which is what MacArthur, you know, let's unleash everything and attack them and kind of hope for the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it had been a nuclear war with China, then the Russians would have been involved immediately as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, Russia had a defense treaty with China. You know, Stalin wouldn't have wanted nuclear war with America. On the other hand, he wouldn't have wanted the U.S. to take out the Chinese communists. So it would have been a very dicey situation. He might very well have moved on Europe. That would have been a way to put pressure on the U.S. So I think, you know, from everyone's standpoint, clearly the Truman administration made the right decision. You know, sorry, you know, Douglas, this is just not, this is a crazy idea. You go home.
Right. Now, well, the one thing that Truman did that I agreed with, although in the context of a war, I would have never had him fight in the first place. But so anyway, but to bring this back up to our current standards, I guess what you're saying, well, Japan is an example, right? They would go to war over Japan if China and Japan got into the fight. But you're saying with Taiwan, it maybe is not so clear?
That's right. I think Taiwan is simply more complicated. You look at it geographically, it's a lot closer. You know, it's much harder to defend. It's a smaller country. It's, you know, less critical. It doesn't have the long, clear kind of alliance relationship in quite the same way that Japan has. It has not had the presence of U.S. troops. I mean, and, you know, the reality is most of the countries of the world don't recognize Taiwan as being independent. All of that kind of puts Taiwan in a different position. I think today, if China attacked Taiwan, the U.S. would probably intervene. But I think, you know, we may very well be moving to a world where 10 or 20 years from now that could easily change, simply because of realities in the region where the U.S. won't be able to guarantee that it could overcome Chinese, you know, deterrent capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now I saw this thing. Oh, I think it was probably the war nerd over there at the Exiled was talking about how aircraft carriers are nothing but targets for ballistic missiles, which just simply means missiles falling from out of the sky on top of them.
I mean, carriers,
you know, sea skimming.
Are wonderful.
If it's a sea skimming missile, they can shoot their radar and and their Gatling guns at it and try to take it out. But a ballistic missile, it's just a target, he said.
That's right, and that's what the Chinese are really building up. What the Chinese understand is they don't have to have 11 carrier groups like America. All they need is the ability to sink carriers. And then that forces the president to decide, does he want to put at risk a ship with 6,000 people on it and explain to the American people how he managed to lose one of these, you know, massive, you know, creations? No president wants to be in that position. So the Chinese, you know, they're wonderful for projecting power. You know, you send them off to the coast of some third world country, you can bomb it into oblivion. But, you know, it turns out if you're up against a sophisticated opponent, then suddenly the world changes and it becomes a big target.
Right. Yeah, and I think it was Jeff Huber, the late, great Jeff Huber, who wrote about how they don't even make them out of steel anymore. You know, they're a few inches thick, the armor on these boats. They're not even really made for fighting with, you know, compared to the kind of ships that the Navy had in World War II, which were made to take a pounding and not sink.
Well, part of it is, of course, missiles, or, you know, the firepower is increased exponentially.
Sure.
So it's pretty hard to put enough armor in to stop that missile. So to some degree, I think they emphasize speed at this point as opposed to, you know, throwing on extra armor that probably wouldn't help very much anyway.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, we're coming up on a break here. We're talking with Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute, and we're talking about this piece in the Washington Post, U.S. model for a future war fans tensions with China and inside the Pentagon, about all these studies for how to fight a winnable war against China. It seemed to be, you know, possibly one of those self-fulfilling prophecies trying to gin up a crisis where there's not one, sort of thing. Anyway, we'll be right back to talk about more Asia issues. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute. And we're going over this piece in the Washington Post, U.S. model for a future war fans tensions with China and inside the Pentagon. And basically, it's about these war games and basically tabletop exercises and whatever at this thing called the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a defense think tank. And they've collected quite a little welfare check here running these war games. And but the thing is, I'm not exactly sure what supposedly were the consequences in China, but some guys in the People's Liberation Army apparently got really livid over this. Doug, does that matter? Is this a big deal?
Well, not really. I mean, the People's Liberation Army have a lot of reasons to be irritated with the United States. I wouldn't worry about that. What I worry is that it's part of a larger pattern. I mean, you know, the Obama administration is putting some troops into Australia, not enough to actually have any meaningful military impact, but enough to irritate the Chinese. You know, we tell the Chinese this, we tell them that, we put troops here, we have these relationships. The danger is you create a hostile relationship with them. You start treating them like the enemy, they're more likely to behave like the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So I view this as simply one piece of it. You know, this, you know, back when the Bush one administration, there was a story about an American plan, you know, war fighting plan against India. You know, it was just one of these kind of silly things that they had as a, you know, an option there in case something happened, and the Indians were mad about it. But as a practical matter, nothing much, you know, came of it.
Mm-hmm.
What's more important today is everything else besides this. You put it all together, then you have to worry about poisoning the relationship.
Right. Man, I read this great piece by Chris Floyd one time about a plan between the world wars to invade Canada and Mexico at the same time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is if you sit at the Pentagon, your job is to think the unthinkable, be ready for any contingency, that kind of thing. So, I mean, they come up with some really wacky stuff, which it's just, you know, hard to imagine would ever have any relevance to anything. But then, you know, strange things have happened, so they feel the need to do so.
Yeah. All right, now, I'm glad you brought up the Marines in Australia, because I was going to. What is the purpose? How many are there? Just a few thousand, right?
Yeah, it's like 2,500 or something.
Right, right. So, what is the point of that, except to, because it's not like, you know, a little Marine base costs that much, so it's not the welfare for Halliburton to build the base, right? It's got to be something more important than that.
Oh, I think it's symbolism. I mean, I think the problem here is they seem to think the symbolic message is the Chinese will be impressed and say, oh my, you know, America is serious. The Chinese are much more likely to say, oh, you know, these irritating people, they're trying to, you know, kind of bother us again. You know, that we think that they should be impressed at the fact we put 2,500 Marines there. My guess is they are more likely to be irritated because they'll look at that and say, you know, there's no military value in it. You know, it's simply a symbolic gesture from their standpoint that says, up yours.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, if they want to be impressive, put 20,000. Do something.
That's right.
Enough to, I don't know, seize the center of somebody's town somewhere. I don't know.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. It's, the whole thing is ridiculous. All right. Well, and so that goes to the real question here of what's all this about? Because when it comes to plutocrats and Wall Street and all them, they like China, right? Cheap labor, and they have the Navy, the U.S. Navy, to socialize the cost of all their security for the distribution. And what a great deal. Since the 1970s, we've had a really great deal between billionaires in America and, I guess, millionaires and billionaires in China, too, and their communist state there. So why in the world would the powers that be interested in any of this other than maybe just Lockheed? But doesn't Lockheed have to kind of go along with the rest of corporate culture a little bit on big questions like this? Or how does this work?
Well, actually, about the only people who you know, like China is corporate America. And basically everybody else hates it, and that's the problem, is you have human rights activists, you have religious activists, you have labor unions on the trade issue, you have hawks. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people out there who kind of come together in an odd coalition. And so China has a lot of enemies out there. And, you know, for a long time, corporate America kind of dominated the agenda, but less so today. A lot of these other issues, security, trade, and whatnot, have come up. And they aren't really positive for you know, supporters of China.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I look at this in this Post piece. It says with Joe Lieberman and John Cornyn, they inserted language into the defense authorization bill requiring the Pentagon to issue a report this year detailing their plans for implementing the concept. They want to see which weapons would you use and are you training for it? And they want to just go ahead and spend as much money as they can on this thing.
That's right. So of course, at least Lieberman is one of the great war hawks in the Senate. So he's the kind of guy who wants to have as big a military as possible and be as kind of obnoxious, as arrogant, and as interventionist as possible. So he almost certainly views this as the U.S. should be over there kind of, shoving the Chinese around, showing them that we're boss.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't know if Cornyn has ever made himself a leader on these things. He's, uniformly bad on them.
That's right. I'm not sure why he's involved in this in particular, but he is, he is not a particular friend of liberty. So, at least on international issues, he's the kind of guy who's much more hawkish.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There are a lot of problems with China, but it's very strange to me how people would see taking a confrontational stance as the solution to that when, hey, even Nixon, or only Nixon, or whatever is the cliche you prefer, like Nixon, that devil, said, we ought to have peace with this billion people in the world. What do we need trouble with them for? Let's all, we'll trade, we'll begin the healing, and maybe it takes a while, and maybe things aren't perfect there or here either, for that matter. When it comes to internet security violations and privacy violations, America and China are the only two that really compare with each other in the world right now. So, and when it comes to prison populations and executions too. So, maybe we're becoming more like them as they're becoming more like us. But geez, the last thing we want to do is get in a fight with them. Maybe if we work together a little bit better, we could both do better.
That's right. No, I mean, having these two countries, and more importantly, the people of these two countries cooperate, you can imagine having a lot of positive things happen. So it's in both countries' interest not to have any conflict.
And now it really is unimaginable that they would do anything so stupid as to really get us into a fight, right? It's all posturing and whatever, but there's got to be a limit somewhere.
Well, I think it is at the moment primarily posturing. I think the danger is everyone assumes that it couldn't happen, and that's the dangerous moment. Because, well, maybe it can't, but if you look at World War I, prior to the war, you had, in certain ways, rising tide of liberalism, and there was more trade, and countries, seemed to be working together on different things, and suddenly, in a couple of months, they all found themselves at war. So one has to be very careful, and it's dangerous to assume it could never happen because it has in the past.
Right. Well, and of course, when we're making things that aren't our business, like, well, maybe that's not the right way to say it. It is our business, right? Exxon over there in the South China Sea has a deal with the Philippines, and the Chinese and the Philippines are in a dispute. And because it's Exxon, that makes it Uncle Sam's business.
Well, we tend to think everything is our business, so this is merely part and parcel of that.
I mean, that ought to sound crazy to people, that we have a dispute that far away. It's like having a border dispute with Russia in the Caucasus. Like, hey, that's pretty far from North America here, guys.
That's right. But, of course, there were people who suggested we get involved in the Russian war against Georgia, so it just shows how, for some people, there are no limits.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that was one report, I guess, by Ron Suskind, right, was that Dick Cheney insisted that they shoot missiles at the tunnels beneath the mountains at the Russian troops coming through.
Yeah, supposedly it went up to a cabinet meeting, and I don't know how serious it was discussed, but the mere fact anyone would have even discussed it shows what a dangerous situation we were in.
See, I like to imagine that they all said, okay, well, forget that. But, it might have got further than that,
That's right.
It all came down to Stephen Hadley and George Bush and those two and their calm, patient wisdom and experience that kept that crisis from escalating further.
That's right. No, I mean, it could have been a disastrous situation. Thankfully, we did
all
not.
All humanity
take that
hanging by a thread.
Yep.
By Stephen Hadley.
I know.
The guy that funneled the forged Niger uranium documents into the president's speech. All right.
Yeah,
well,
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, at least we didn't die that time.
Yep, that's
all right. Hey, listen, I always like talking with you, Doug. I learn a lot. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Take care now.
That's the great Doug Bandow, everybody, from the Cato Institute. Also, he's writing for Forbes magazine at forbesblogs.forbes.com/Doug Bandow. We'll be right back. ScottHorton.org.